The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So here at IMC, one of the primary practices we do is mindfulness. And so then it begs the question, what is mindfulness? Or what's the full potential of mindfulness? What's the various functions of mindfulness? So I want to speak to some aspect of this today and start with some analogies. Suppose that if you go to visit a country where you don't know, go to live in a country where you don't speak the language, there's various challenges that you have to do, many challenges to get by and find your way and buy groceries and get a job and, you know, all kinds of things have to be taken care of. But you don't know the language. And so you have to be very creative about sign language and, you know, problem solving. And it's a, you know, big enterprise to make it all work. However, you could also decide to get to take a class in the local language and learn the language. It might take a while, but once you learn the language, then it's a lot easier to negotiate your way through that culture. So, you know, there's a way of making the whole thing easier, that is, learn the language. Or if you want to cross a large valley, large field, that's thick with mud. So you need to get to the other side. So you start walking through the mud and you sink in up to your knees, and you're walking through the mud. It's, you know, it's heavy going and it's tough going, and maybe even it occurs to you, you wish there was another way, but you know, that's where you're going over there, so you have to go. Yeah. Once you're far enough in, even if you want to go back, you have to go through the slush, through the mud. And then you kind of squint your eyes a little bit, and you see there, kind of far on the horizon, you see in the edge of the field, or near somewhere, you see there's an elevated dry road that goes through the valley. And so, oh, there's hope for you. And so then you start sludging your way towards that road to make it easier for you, because if you can get up there where it's dry, it'd be easier to walk. But then halfway to the road, you say, wait a minute. You know, it's really pleasant, this feeling of the mud through the toes, and it's really nice, and, you know, it feels such close contact with earth, the earth element and the Mother Earth, and it's really good, and I shouldn't leave, you know, this wonderful place and go up in the dry land. And, you know, it's kind of aloof, and, you know. Or then you look around, you see all these other people walking through the mud, and kind of pulling their knees up and trying to get out and move along. You say, well, you know, I can't leave these people behind. I can't leave these people behind because, you know that we should all be in it together, and you know, they're my family after all. And so, or then it occurs to you that, well, I don't really deserve to be out of it. It's really... I've had a bad life, you know. I've done all kinds of terrible things. I'm basically a bad person, and so I deserve to be, you know, make it, you know, I really need to repent or atone, or I just, you know, who am I to kind of get out of this mess? I think I just need to slog through it some more. But somehow, by mistake, you end up, you know, up there in the dry road, and it's a lot easier to walk through. And this is, walking is easy. You're out of the mud. Or you get a splinter in your sole of your foot. And so walking is tricky. But you figure it out. You get crutches and walk with crutches for a while. That works pretty well. Or you kind of, you know, walk on your heel. That works really well. You can avoid pushing the splinter in. Or you get this wonderful, you know, multi-layered shoe that's built up with layers, and so the top layer is just an incredibly soft cotton. And so you can walk, because, you know, you have all this cushioning, you figured it all out. Or you can reach down and just pull out the splinter. You know, that's a lot easier, right? Or you can walk around being tense in your stomach, holding your stomach in. If you're really tired and exhausted and painful, this tense stomach, and it occurs to you, maybe it would be good to get a really good massage. And so you go get a good job to earn the money for a massage. And And finally, you know, you get to the masseuse, and the masseuse says, "Yeah, I can massage your stomach, but you know, it'd be easier if you just relaxed your belly." Oh. So these kind of analogies are kind of pointing to it. You know, there's going to be a big transition, a new radical new way, perspective or way of being in the world that maybe is not, you know, evident in the way we live our life now. And so we're in the maze, and we're kind of going through the maze of life with our face pointing down in the maze. And the walls of the maze are only 5 feet high. If you're standing tippy toe, you can look over and then you see the way out. But if you're in the maze, you know, you're trying to figure it all out. So mindfulness meditation or mindfulness kind of helps you stand up, look around, and see there's a whole different perspective to understand this life we're in that can change your relationship to yourself and your life in a very radical way. If you can put up with one more analogy, maybe you've had this experience of maybe being at a party or in a group gathering of people, and perhaps there's some behavior is going on, big argument about politics or some big argument about something, or perhaps some behavior that's kind of that you thought was fun, drinking and you know whatever, and then you have to leave, go to the bathroom or something, go out, and then you come back and you're standing at the edge of the door kind of looking in, and you see they're still at it, but you've stepped out, you're not part of it, and you say, wait a minute, I don't know if I want to go back in there. You know, and now that I'm out of it, it just doesn't seem to be worth it, you know. And so there's a kind of that perspective, that distance, you have, you know, oh, that behavior, that activity is not quite what I want to do. So mindfulness is kind of like, it could be many things for different people. The simple definition of it is just paying attention to what's going on. But to pay attention carefully to what's going on, often that attention that we bring to our life, the knowing to what's going on, comes along with a lot of baggage. A lot of other things come along. It's not pure awareness, pure attention. So I could be upset about something, and I could know that I'm upset. Oh yeah, I know, I'm so upset, poor Gil. It's so hard. And those people, you know, I need to let these people know how upset I am. You know, I know, you know, I'm being mindful, right? I know I'm upset. But I'm in the mud. You know, poor Gil. I hope you all feel sorry for me. So that's being mindful, but, you know, but there's a whole other way of being mindful, which is where I don't wallow in self-pity and know that I'm, you know, but I pull myself out of the upsetness. Oh, I'm really upset here. And I get upset. I kind of, I'm like an adult, you know, like, oh, look at this. This is what's happening here. I'm upset. And we don't add on to that my self-pity, my desire to get other people to like me or fix me or take care of me or whatever. Just, oh, I can stand on my own 2 feet, stand and say, I'm upset. Look at that. Wow. You know, it's very simple. So I've kind of managed to pull myself out of the mud a little bit. And I think it's a big challenge sometimes to have a clear acknowledgement, clear recognition, clear seeing of what's happening for us, where we've pulled ourselves out of the entanglement we have with what's happening. And there can be a lot of beliefs, a lot of ideas of why it's important to stay entangled. And some of those are subconscious. We don't even realize they're there. So, you know, one of them is we often go through our life, maybe very mindful enough, but not aware of how much the mindfulness is self-referential to all the ideas we have about what I need, what I deserve, who I am in relationship to other people, how other people see me, how I judge other people. And these kind of can be embedded in the mindfulness itself. And so the mindfulness is helpful perhaps, but it's not as helpful as it could be because we're still walking in the mud. We still haven't learned the language of the land. And so part of the opportunity of mindfulness is to recognize what's happening clearly enough, strongly enough, that you feel actually you've kind of stepped out of the arguments. You stepped out of the mud. You stepped out of the maze so you can see more clearly what's going on. So what does it take to acknowledge something clearly enough? And I've had been in situations where I have been upset, and it sometimes has been quite a struggle. I kind of know that I'm stuck in the upset. Sometimes I don't want to be unstuck, because if I get unstuck from being upset, then the person can get away with it. You know, if I hold my anger, then you know, then it's just right for that person. I'll be miserable, so the other person, you know, can somehow hopefully rub off on that person. It's not a very useful way of living. But or there can be some all kinds of things where I'm so interested in that upset, or I'm so angry at being upset, that I kind of engaged and reacting and doing all this stuff with it. And even though I know I'm upset, I'm not really willing to stand on my own two feet, take a deep breath, and really acknowledge in some full way, wow, there's upset here. Like maybe do it, oh yes, I'm upset. And that lousy no good person, I get pulled right back in. You know, it's so quick sometimes. And so the opportunity with mindfulness is not just mindfulness in the small M. Oh yes, I'm aware of this. You know, we're looking for mindfulness with a big M. The mindfulness where the mindfulness pulls us out of the mud, pulls us out from being entangled, pulls us above the fray, so we can really stand here and really acknowledge in some purity of the moment, oh, this is what's happening here. Here, oh, this. And it's at times it's really easy to do that. At times it's difficult, and at times it's heroic to be able to kind of take that position, stand on your own two feet, and just acknowledge in the simplicity of the situation, this is what's happening, this is how I am, this is what's happening. Because the belief systems, the attachments, the ideas of needs you have, your very sense of identity can be tied into being in the fray, being connected to, being engaged in all this. And to pull yourself out and just be here very simply, this kind of simplicity of being, and recognize what's happened, pulls the rug from underneath much of how we've kind of built up our sense of self and our sense of values and who we need to be in the world around us. So sometimes that's heroic. And what I suggest that looks like it's going to be heroic, that's really productive to engage in the exhausting exploration of what's really going on. Don't assume that your ideas of what you need, your identity, who you need to be in relationship to other people, what you need to have a successful life, is as it needs to be. Question it. Part of the function of mindfulness is to encourage you to question your life in a very deep way. And so, it could be, it's in a sense, it's very simple. You're trying to find out how to be aware, fully aware what's here in this world of ours, in our life of ours, but to do it with an awareness which is independent of what you know. So if I say, if I'm feeling physical pain, I've been in a situation where I have knee pain in meditation, for example, and I'm aware of it, mindful of it, like this. Oh, pain. Oh, the pain is so bad. Oh, I got to be mindful of the pain. I'll feel it better. Oh, yeah. So, Or I've, stand my own two feet and say, oh, there's pain. Oh, there's pain and a lot of self-pity. Self-pity. Look at that self-pity. Those thoughts of self-pity operating. Self-pity. Pain. And there's a world of difference. And when I was early in my meditation life, I saw, for me, the difference was when I leaned into it or held kind of entangled with it, oh my, poor pain, poor Gil. I could feel the muscles around the knee tighten up and hurt more. And when I can take that independent mindfulness, oh, there's pain here, and not get entangled with it, a little bit, to some degree, I could feel that the muscles of self-pity loosen up. And it was more manageable. So I lose track of where I was going with this. Well, we'll have to wait a moment until it comes back or some new something new happens. So So that, you know, I want to encourage you that it's very worthwhile when it's difficult to do this. It isn't like you're failing in the mindfulness, but actually the questioning, the exploration, that when it's difficult to have this independent mindfulness, is actually very rich. And some people who practice mindfulness assume that you're supposed to be able to kind of practice some kind of pure, independent mindfulness just like that. And if you're not doing it, you're a meditation failure. I think a little bit of mindfulness that shows you what's, you know, that challenges you, and you invite the challenge to explore and find out what's going on for you, is actually much more realistic and helpful than some idealistic idea of kind of, oh, now I'm going to be, you know, out of the mud and walking on the dry land, thank you. It'd be nice if you can get there. And that's certainly part of the potential of mindfulness, is to learn how to find a place where the mindfulness is independent. Now, when you start getting a sense, getting close to that sense, place of mindfulness that you're knowing, mindfulness and knowing are almost synonymous. So you know something, but in knowing it, you're independent of what you know. To know and be independent of what you know. So it reminds me of this popular saying in our circles that came from a long ago. A meditation teacher said to a woman, the thoughts of your mother are not your mother. And that helped her so much. The thoughts of your enemy is not your enemy. The thoughts of your past is not really your past. The thoughts are thoughts. They're constructs. And many times we're reacting to our thinking, our thoughts, our ideas. And so to see an idea as an idea, to see that an idea as an idea, is to help you find a place where you can know you have a thought, but the knowing is not the thought. If we're living in our thoughts, if we live through our thoughts, our thinking, then, in a sense, knowing and thinking are entangled. But there's an opportunity to step back and simply, in a very simple way, know, oh, I'm thinking. I'm thinking. Someone cuts you off in traffic and you get angry. And you're going to do something with your finger, it occurs to you. Let me just kind of line up my car nearby. Like someone did that in San Jose, right? Something like that. Recently got killed. And, you know, it was tragic. Because not only was the person shot, but his kids were in the back seat. So, you know, a moment of lost mindfulness is very consequential. So, so here you are. So, what is it like to see your anger, your thought of wanting to do something as just a thought, and have that clear place of independence where you can do, oh, I don't have to pick that up. I don't have to get involved in that. I can't necessarily stop thinking that way, but I don't have to be that thought. But if we don't have that clear separation, then we almost like become those thoughts. And if we are those thoughts, then we don't have as much freedom to maneuver and to choose what we want to do. So what is it to know, to be mindful, to recognize, and have the mindfulness help you become independent? And in the teachings of the Buddha, the direction that mindfulness is going is to come to a place where you're independent of what you know. But you still know. You know, independent of what you know, it doesn't mean that you don't know. You're still very cognizant and aware and alert to this life of ours, but there's a kind of sense of independence. It's not aloof. Not any more than, hopefully, than, you know, in the complicated social chaos of nursery school, the two nursery school teachers stand up in the middle of the crowd and look at each other and wink and say, the kids are doing it again. As opposed to, you know, these kids. You know, the nursery school teacher is not aloof, unloving, but their nursery teacher knows to be independent from, she took my toy. How could she do it again? You know, You know, there's a clear, there's an adult kind of presence. So how do we do this? How do we learn this? And I'd like to offer you maybe, I don't know, at least one little technique or aid that we use in our tradition that I use, that I find very helpful to kind of, you know, especially when I'm kind of in the mud, I find it very helpful as a way of kind of beginning to kind of find my way out, pull my way out. Sometimes it's hard, you know, the mud sucks you in. And that is to name what's happening in the mind, very silently, to label it. Upset. And to very calmly, maybe keep it going, and as I say it, to begin explore what it's like to be free of the experience of being upset. Where is it? Where am I tangled with it? What are the tentacles that are holding me to it? The beliefs, the ideas, the attachments? And keep saying it until see if I can say it very calmly. And can I begin freeing my breath, my breathing, from the experience? Because if your breathing is tight and constricted, you're entangled and caught. If your breathing is loose and relaxed, then you're more likely to be independent. So, upset. I say it a couple of times, making progress, upset. And then I relax, forget about it. And then it sneaks right in. Like you step on the slippery, I step on the edge of the dry ground, and you know I'm not paying attention. I slip right in. You know, I get complacent. I got to keep it up a little for a while. Oh, there it is. Let's acknowledge it. It's lessening. Good. I was getting much better now. I'll stop paying attention. Slip right in. But you keep it up. Just notice. Oh, so and naming, and then I find it's sometimes. In the very quiet naming in the mind, it's kind of like a full acknowledgement. It's a fuller acknowledgement. And probably you've had that experience of being something difficult in your life, something's going on. Maybe it's not difficult, it could be something beautiful. But someone comes along and names it. You know, you hadn't really seen it, hadn't really understood it. And some friends comes along and names it. Like, you know, you're pretty happy. Oh yeah, you're right. I am. I hadn't really taken it in. I was so busy being, you know, engaged. Oh, someone names it. So this fuller acknowledgement is a very powerful force in the psyche. It can help free us of things. It can help clarify. It can loosen things up. It can let things move, so they can kind of unfold in their kind of way. So the name, very very softly, and then sometimes I found as I name the experience, the tone of the inner voice that does the naming is very instructive. Pain. I'm naming it pain. That's very different than pain, you know. Or sometimes if it's a nice thing, you know. Oh, pleasure. Oh. Well, that's nice, right? But what's the problem with that? Oh, pleasure. Oh, is that I have gotten entangled. We're not only entangled in the difficulty, we get ourselves entangled in the wonderful things too. And then you say, what is this? And now you're getting suspicious of me. Wait a minute. It was all good when you talked about upset. But, you know, what's wrong with being entangled with the good things? There's nothing inherently wrong with having, experiencing good, wonderful things. But if you're entangled with it, your chances are pretty high that you're setting the conditions to suffer down the line. It's much better to have pleasure and have that independent knowing presence while you're experiencing it. It's much more pleasant. It has a different quality. The kind of pleasure is to have different quality, different character to it than if you're kind of enmeshed in it. So if I say, oh, pleasure, oh, that's very different than, oh, pleasure is happening. Pleasure. Well, but I'm supposed to be, you know, really, I deserve that pleasure. I should really kind of lean into it and get into it. You know, savor a tantric pleasure of eating this strawberry. Well, you know, it's good. It's fine. But what happens, what I've found happens, is that as this sense of mindfulness with the big M, the knowing quality, gets stronger, it's so satisfying. the clarity of it, the crispness of it, the wakefulness of it is so great. But it's kind of a clarity and satisfaction that it maybe is kind of easily forgotten, because it's kind of like having the air be completely clear and clean. And you see the mountains across the bay, and you, wow, I forgot if there were mountains over there. They seem so close. You know, it's so clear, it's so satisfying, it's so wonderful to have that wakefulness. When the smog settles in, again, the haze settles in, and life goes back to usual, we even forget there's, you know, mountains over in the East Coast, East Bay. So something very satisfying about this wakefulness. I'm awake. And so a knowing which is independent of what it knows. And what I haven't said is a knower that's independent of what is known. Because as soon as you have a knower, it's a magnet for all the ideas you have of what it means to be a knower, a self, an individual. And there's also, when you have a knower, you have a fixed reference point, the one who knows, which is not really completely free. Because then, in a sense, oh, there's knowing, but I'm the knower, thank you. Knowing can exist without any reference to a knower. Of course, we know it's you that knows. We're not going to say, you know, it's not you, but in the fullness, the full clarity of the moment, there's no need to add, I am knowing. There's just knowing. And it's so peaceful, it's so simple, it's so satisfying, it's so simple that the mind probably will say, it can't be that simple. It can't be that simple. I have to prove myself. I have to apologize. I have to do or accomplish. I have to defend myself. I have to show people how smart I am. Knowing is not smart. And it's not unsmart. It's just knowing. So the whole, you know, in you know, mindfulness, it said mindfulness is always useful. And part of what we do in Buddhist practice is, very slowly, as we do mindfulness practice, we're purifying the mindfulness. We're clarifying the mindfulness. We're strengthening the mindfulness until the mindfulness itself becomes almost like a presence, an entity in its own right, a force, something that has, you know, you kind of recognize, oh, there it is. If you're kind of very casually aware of something, and you're completely involved in everything, and you kind of know what's going on, you'll have very little sense that the mindfulness is a force or a power in its own right. But as the mindfulness becomes stronger, and you pull yourself out of the mud, the entanglement, it's almost like you have a companion. It's almost like you have this wonderful ally or presence. In the same way, perhaps, that if you go work out at the gym, perhaps, and you feel really good, a lot of good coursing energy and vitality, and you come out, and you feel so much bigger, and you feel like there's presence and strength with you. And in that kind of fullness of that strength, the inner strength, someone tells you that they don't like the color of your hair, it just kind of like it bounces right off, you know, because you're just full. But if you're feeling kind of down and meshed in the mud, and mud is so hard and difficult, or the mud is so great, I love this mud, and someone says they don't like the color of your hair, you know, it might be pretty consequential. So I don't know if that's a good analogy, but the idea of mindfulness itself becomes like a presence. So a presence. And so much so that I'm actually, you know, talking with Christians sometimes, I'm comfortable enough saying that a mindfulness practice is kind of comparable, not the same thing, but it's kind of similar to practicing the presence of God. I don't know. I have no idea what God is. But it must be pretty good. For those people who have it. So it's comparable, this sense of the presence, the sense of real presence. And I kind of think that we have an advantage in the fact that we just have presence without any subject or any object. It's, you know, just presence. So I hope that in some way this talk is offers you a kind of different perspective, a challenging perspective on mindfulness practice, how to kind of move it to a different level or to kind of notch it up, and it would be very satisfying to me if you were challenged by this, even if you got upset by it. I wouldn't want you to be upset and just stay upset with me. Then you wouldn't have been challenged to in yourself. I hope you're challenged with yourself. What is it? What is it? How can this interface between this idea of an independent mindfulness and what keeps me from that? That's what I want you to be engaged in. Anyway, so we have about 6-7 minutes, and now I can hear how upset you are, if you'd like, or questions you have, or something.
It seems like what you're describing is something that I can do when I'm sitting. When I'm sitting, yes. When I'm practicing a meditation.
Or when you're alone. Something like that. Anyway, yes, when you're sitting.
And it seems like as soon as I get off the cushion, all of those thoughts, feelings that I had calmed come rushing back. And, I know that ultimately, I would like to get to the point where there's not a big difference between sitting and the rest of my life. Right now, there is. And I'm just wondering if you could say something about that.
Yeah, I think everyone will feel a difference. There's a difference. And, in part, mindfulness, the meditation is a training. And slowly, by osmosis, it carries over into our daily life. And you don't know when it's going to really, it might help in some very small ways, a little bit in improving your daily life. It's probably the operating some, making you a little bit calmer. It might also sometimes click in at a time of crisis, when you really need something. Then all of meditation experience you have, that's when that what you've learned there will come into, and you can engage it because it's really, the need is so big. To see the contrast between what happens in meditation and daily life, I think it's very healthy. And one of the hopes I have is that people are inspired by that difference, and then to try to bring the mindfulness more into the daily life, and to find ways to do it in daily life, in small ways, in big ways, and not just leave it on the cushion. So maybe it's as simple as deciding, when I am alone and I'm making dinner, or making breakfast or cleaning up or something, let me see if I can do it with the mindfulness, in a mindful way. There's some activity, find something. I've known people who their teacher sent them to, they were doing a lot of meditation, but the teacher wanted them to learn more about mindfulness in daily life, and the teacher sent them to, this is in the Zen tradition, to train in a Japanese tea ceremony, because that was a way of practicing in daily life. Or I've known another Zen student who was sent by the teacher to learn pottery, because somehow to learn mindfulness and activity. So to have some activity that you do where you can do it, can bridge, make that bridge. And another kind of bridge and help that I find very, very significant is do your meditation. Ideally, add 10 minutes more time, not to meditate, but add 10 minutes to the session. If you can't add 10 minutes to the session, then truncate your session by 10 minutes, your meditation period itself. But have a session where you have 10 minutes at the end of getting, when you get up from meditation, where a transition time, where you're committed to being mindful, to continue in that spirit of the meditation itself. So you're not going to rush into doing everything at once. And during that time, you start your daily life again. And watch, for the first time as you get up, where you grab, where your mind hurries up, where you get, you know, tight or whatever. And then stop. Maybe even sit down again in your chair, close your eyes, and take stock. Study that. What happened? Why did I do that? What did I believe? What were the feelings? What were the emotions? What was all going on there? And then if you do that over the weeks and the months, my guess is you'll learn a lot about yourself that you haven't learned on the cushion. And as you learn about yourself, you can also then start questioning whether some of your behavior, some of your beliefs, some of your ideas are really necessary. And it might give you a little bit of a wedge to get in there. And finally, you know, it's really good not to be idealistic in this tradition, but to really feel like it's a way of life. And that slowly, over time, we're slowly making progress and growing and developing. And every little drop makes a difference in the long term. And so it's also a slow process. Yes.
I didn't think I would see myself saying this today, but you seem to struck a chord for me, and I feel it's appropriate for me to share this. So 2 days ago, I had a couple of things that were juxtaposed to one another. One was I had to pay a large tax, which I had prepared myself to. I mean, it came because of a big boom of an investment, last investment, where we finally are debt-free, and we had slowly worked, mindfully worked to get to that place. And then the other was I got diagnosed with prostate cancer. And it was interesting because I have a medical background, for one thing, and the sequence of events that led up to this was I shared with you, I was in Thailand for that retreat for 3 weeks, northern Thailand, and two things came up. At the end, one of our teachers said, just simple few words, just stop chasing the feeling. And it resonated with me in the way that what you said resonated. In other words, the thoughts, the feelings, the symptoms, whatever they are, physical, mental, emotional, is we chase them. We chase those feelings, and that's where we get stuck. So the other thing that happened was I developed a flare up of my stomach. When I left the monastery, I ate primarily Asian food and no problems. And that first night after the retreat, I did a two-hour yoga class, and I had an 8 o'clock dinner, pizza, beer, a Heineken beer, pizza, and a salad. And that next morning, I got a radiating pain in my stomach, and it happened 2 days in a row. And I was afraid that, gee, how am I going to make this 20-hour flight back? And, well, it was uneventful. I got back. And a week went by, and I had one more flare-up. And then it disappeared. And that led me to go to Kaiser. They did an ultrasound of my stomach, found out it was not gallbladder. But in the process was, they normally do other tests. They did a PSA test. So it's interesting that the sequence of events happened and led me to be seen early. I mean, I have a really good prognosis. If I just have to act responsibly and I have time, it's slow growing, and so I feel good about that. And this morning I woke up, well, let me backtrack. Yesterday we woke up, my wife and I went to yoga class at a Buddhist center in San Jose. We went to the farmer's market, and I got an email from my brother-in-law talking about reprioritizing, and I realized that I had been reprioritizing these last 10 years, and I would not change anything that I'm doing. I'm living each day just the way that I want to live it.
So you were prepared.
I was prepared.
And so when this happened, you were able not to be pulled into it or entangled in a way that...
Yeah, I mean, there was an initial shock. I mean, I knew more than 50% I had this.
Yeah.
Because he said on examination he felt an irregular surface and hardening. And because of my medical training, you know, alarm bells went off. And so I knew there was more than 50% chance, but the biopsy confirmed it. So, and we're here today, and I feel really inspired. I don't believe I'm in denial about it. I mean, I'm trying to step, I believe I'm outside of the knower and the knowing, you know, just being with whatever it is. And last night, or this morning, you said about the twilight morning, you know, what's the first thing you latch on to? I thought about this gland and how it's been with me for a long time and how it may need to go. But I had this sense of compassion for it. Instead of being this war on cancer, it was like just being with it. You know, not... Because I struggle so much on retreat about wanting to push away the knee pain, the back pain, all the negative states, emotional state. But just kind of being with it and let life, you know, let the process just...
Great. So I appreciate this. It's kind of a testimonial, I think, of years of practice that you've had this degree of equanimity and balance or freedom with such big challenges. People often drown in these kinds of challenges at times. So congratulations. I'm happy to hear this. That was very nice. I appreciate you saying that. The only thing that lingers in my mind is that don't chase after feelings is a good instruction, but some people need to hear the opposite. That don't run away from them. Some people, that's what they do, is they're running.
Yes. Hey, well, thank you for listening, everybody.
Thank you. So I'll end with a classic Buddhist image that's meaningful for me and maybe kind of caps the morning. And that is the image of the lotus blossom, kind of a Buddhist symbol. And the idea of a lotus blossom is that it's born and grows up out of the muddy waters. But then it blooms above the muddy water. And when it blooms above the muddy water, the petals, I guess, are you know, slippery or just inside a bud or something. So when they blossom, the beautiful, usually white, but can be other colors, white blossom is untouched by the mud. And so the mind of awakening is connected to the world, but the mind opens up, gets released, blossoms in such a beautiful way, and is independent, is not colored by the conditions of the world. So may each of your beautiful minds blossom. Mm-hmm.